Heavy Scramble podcast. If you've been listening to our recent podcast, you'll find out the weather is still quite rainy. Today, the day we're recording, however, it has been quite dry. Freezing, but dry, and I will take that any day of the week. We have a full house once again tonight. We have Mary, who our resident navigator. She's great at directions. Mary, tell us a bit. We'll talk about how you're good at directions before we start recording. And tell us a bit your favourite pigeon.
I feel like I can't be the only person in Glasgow that's seen this pigeon, right? It cuts about Central Station. It's missing a foot. I think it must be its right foot because it's my left. And one of its eyes is hanging out. And it just looks like it needs a wee wash. But it's been on the go for years. Either that or there's a lot of pigeons with deformities in Glasgow Central Station. But I always see them.
Other than that, how are you?
Doing better than the pigeon, that's for sure. No, really excited to talk about film we're going to talk about. I feel like this is going to be one of those pods where, although we usually float off in tangents, I feel like there's plenty to explore on this one.
John, do you have a favourite pigeon?
I used to have one, actually, because there was one that used to, as like Mary said, that one used to kick about Buchanan Street bus station, and it had 2 feet, but one of them, it was like a ball of something that was actually attached to its foot, so it was almost like as if it was hobbling, and nobody wanted to go near it in case the ball burst and a thousand little ants came out of it or something. I don't know. But yeah, that's bizarre that I've just thought about that after all these years. The pigeon with the ball in its foot.
Just, it's like unlocked a Smith song, memory. Isn't it? Yeah.
Other than that, how are you doing?
Ah, not bad. Yeah, it's been a good week. Just kicking about, trying to watch as much stuff as I possibly can. Keep away from work as much as I possibly can as well. But yeah, it's been all right. Yeah, not too bad at all.
Excellent. Good to hear. So the film we'll be discussing tonight is one of 2023's more controversial outings. We're talking about Emerald Fennell's Saltburn, starring Barry Keoghan, Jacob Elordi, Rosamund Pike and Richard D. Grant. As per Wikipedia, focuses on a student at Oxford who becomes fixated with a popular aristocratic fellow student. Barry Keoghan plays the poor student who's obsessed with Jacob Elordi, who's from an aristocratic family, and he finds Barry's character Oliver quite sympathetic, so to speak, and he befriends him and invites him to spend the summer at his eccentric family's estate called Saltburn. Now, work does start off as a fairly straightforward tale of, you know, the difference in classes does evolve quite quickly into a debauched, darkly humoured, and at times just quite odd tale. Now, obviously, there's a lot of things to talk about as well in regards to themes and messages, performances. There's a lot going on here, but we'll just start with, what was your initial thoughts on watching this, Mary?
So I think because I'm probably a bit late to the party on Saltburn, I probably had all of the sort of major shock moments kind of spoiled for me through TikTok and Twitter or whatever it's called these days. So I think that I went in sort of expecting to be a wee bit more shocked than perhaps I initially was. I thought that it was very sort of Talented Mr. Ripley meets Brideshead Revisited type of vibe. It didn't really work for me for a number of reasons that I'm sure we'll go into, but I was left feeling quite disappointed with it. I had a lot more questions than anything. It all felt very surface level for me.
How about yourself, John?
I was kind of the same as Mary in that I hadn't really seen it. I actually only watched it today, just as a sort of last minute thing before we actually recorded the podcast. I thought I'd better actually be informed. Conversely, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty good film based on differences in class and some, you know, the Barry Keoghan role, you've kind of seen it before. And I think this may be more of a British thing rather than an international thing. We have seen class dramas and class thrillers before, whereas it tends not to travel particularly well, that type of film, but because we've seen it, it is very familiar, but I still enjoyed it because it's had elements of all sorts of things that we can obviously go into. Mary's touched on a few of them, and there's the likes of like Another Country and things like that. But yeah, I was really rather impressed. I had managed to miss most of the spoilers as well, which obviously helped. Obviously, I'd heard about Wee Barry coming out to play at one point, but obviously because of the BAFTAs last week. But apart from that, it was reasonably fresh. I went in with certain expectations about it, and I was pleasantly surprised, but that was based on mostly the performances of Rosamund Pike and Richard E. Grant, more than anything else.
Yeah, I kind of am somewhere in the middle with this film, and it's almost contradictory what I'm going to say, is that I did enjoy it. I don't know if I liked it. And what I mean by that is I think the film is incredibly flawed as a narrative story. But I think it's very well shot. And I think the performances are excellent. At surface level, as you mentioned, Mary, I could enjoy the film. However, the film didn't just want me to sit back and watch it. I felt it was like it said, okay, there's a lot of layers to this film. And we're going to tell you what the layers are. And we're going to show you what the layers are. And we want you to think more. I mean, even the tagline for the film was, we're all about to lose our minds. And you alluded to the controversial scenes in it. I didn't see spoilers for these scenes either, John. And when I watched them, I felt, okay, you're trying to shock me for the sake of shocking me. It's adding nothing to the story. It's not really adding anything to the characters. And as much as I like Barry Keoghan's, performance as Oliver, I don't know if it was necessarily playing the same character throughout the film.
No.
So it's interesting that you say that, though, because I did read that Emerald Fennell gave him, or I think he, did she give him 5 different readings of the character? And then would tell him, like, this is Oliver 1, this is Oliver 2, this is Oliver 3. So it was almost like he was playing different characters depending on the scene that he was in. But again, I don't think that's helpful as a viewer. That's maybe helpful as an actor to get you into a sort of process of becoming the character and understanding what the character's motivations or feelings are in a particular scene. But I think as a viewer, it kind of blurs who the character's supposed to be.
Yeah, and it's in many ways, Willem reminded me of Joker in terms of this like, supervillain origin story. However, is it a villain? He's an anti-hero. He's supposed to be on his side. He's supposed to be the bad guy. But I felt this character changed too much through the film. There was no natural evolution of him. I'm still not really too sure I was on his side when it came to the end, but I wasn't on anybody's side come the end. And I end up more feeling sorry for what happened to some of the characters I was despising at the beginning of the film. Because I felt, you know, I don't really deserve that. And I don't really know whose side I was supposed to be on, if anybody. But the film, I felt anyway, was trying to tell me something. It was showing me something different.
I don't think there was any development in the characters. And I think there was the reason for that was they were all fully formed at the start. And you were there to make an opinion about each of the characters. And once you realised that there wasn't going to be any development, and you were actually just focusing on the story rather than thinking, well, this character's going to change, he's going to grow or whatever. I saw that pretty early on because at the very start, you see the Ollie character is a slightly older man based on the fact that he's parted his hair a bit more severely rather than anything else. And I thought that it was kind of quite a nice way to bookend the whole story. You had that at the very start, and this isn't giving anything away, at the very start and the very end, and maybe a couple of scenes in between, but you didn't know what it was. It almost looked as if it was an interview to begin with, because he was speaking directly to camera, so it could have been therapy, it could have been an interview about how successful he'd become or something, because he was dressed in like sort of a suit and a shorty looked sort of business-like, or it could have been like a police interview or something. You just didn't know because obviously the story was still to unfold at that point. But yeah, there was no development at all. All these characters were as they were probably for years before that. And that's a take on privilege and class, because you see, people are born into their circumstances. So if you're born into riches and wealth, it's just certain things are just expected, and people just accept that right away. And the same with the Ollie character. When he's introduced, he says, you know, he came from a broken home, and his parents were addicts and all this sort of stuff. So you get an idea of what the characters are meant to be like right away. And that doesn't change. And I was quite happy with that, actually. Once I realised there wasn't going to be any changes or growth or any insights in that way, I was like, okay, right, so I don't need to concentrate on that. I can think about some of the other stuff that's actually and what's actually been put out on screen and thinking about that instead.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for me to talk about some of the criticisms of the characters without giving away spoilers.
But would you have a spoiler warning and go into it?
We might as well, yes. It's one of these films that you can skirt about the edges and talk about things, but if you really want to get into the meat of the matter, then that wasn't I wasn't meaning anything by that, but I think we'll go into sort of spoiler territory.
Consider this a spoiler warning then. At the beginning of the film, he's very kind of pitiful and sympathetic because he's coming from this lower privileged background. He's at Oxford. It doesn't fit in with all these rich people. He's got to the bar. He can't afford a round. You feel sorry for him quite quickly. And as the film goes on, you see how he's sort of rejected and embraced as a joke figure by this rich family. So he eventually takes them all down one at a time, destroys their lives. But then at the end of the film, so it's almost like a revenge type fantasy. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you see flashbacks where it's almost like he's planned this from the start. But why has he planned this from the start? Because he doesn't seem to have any motivation to destroy this family other than what then happens to him. And then you find out himself, he's not actually from this lower class background either. He's fairly well off. He's more well off than he's letting on. He talks about his parents being alcoholics and his dad being dead. And all that's just not true. It comes from a really nice, loving family. I just don't understand what was really going on at that point. I got confused by that. That's what I mean. You get to the end and you're like, is this guy the anti-hero? Is he a villain? It's like the film has made a choice and expects you to go along with that choice. But it just left people confused.
That was the biggest issue for me, was the fact that, now obviously he's revealed to be a liar to sort of plant the seed that he's not a trustworthy person or whatever. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was like, well, I couldn't understand the motivations, because he seemingly, now since we're talking class, obviously, which is a sort of exclusively British thing, you know, he seemed to be from a sort of middle class home. You know, it was a nice detached red brick bungalow and all the rest of it, and his parents were sort of in their twin set and pedals kind of thing. So it's not like he did have the really rough life and he was like, oh, fuck all these rich people, you know, I'm going to take them down because I've had nothing. It was like, no, you just came from slightly, well, not slightly less, but do you know what I mean? Like, the gap wasn't big enough to justify this, as you say, seemingly premeditated assault. And for me, I was like, well, unless he knew who Felix was prior to starting at Oxford, how did he pick the right mark? How did he know how this was all going to unravel? It just, nothing made sense. And from the sort of motivation perspective for me, and I think that's where I really struggled with it.
And the thing is as well, so I'm talking about that kind of flashback scene, you see him at the bar and you feel like sorry for him. Mm-hmm. When I saw you with the bag around and Felix comes over and he's like, so I'll get this one. And you're thinking, Felix seems like a nice guy. And let's be honest, for the majority of that film, Felix is nothing but nice to him.
Well, he's a product of his upbringing. So he's nice to him, but he is sort of joining in the mockery of, oh, he doesn't understand that this is how you have your breakfast in this type of house, or this is what you wear to dinner at this type of event. So he is slightly joining in the mocking, although he does tell his parents to stop making fun of him because he has had a hard life. But in a way, Felix is harmless, because yes, he's the sort of classic snotty rich twat that goes to Oxford, but he's not actively being horrible to him, to Oliver, like so many other characters are. He is just kind of there, as it were.
Yeah. And then that last part, you see him at the party, he's pretending they can't afford the round. that you see actually does have money. So it was a bit of a leap for me for him to go, I know this guy so well, he's going to come over and pay this round because he feels sorry for me. Then that's going to get me in deeper with him. Then he's going to invite me to see his family. Then I'm going to trick them all into loving me. Then I'm going to kill them all and take the house. And I'm like, eh?
Yeah. And also for a film that I think is supposed to be a kind of eat the rich type of, oh, look how awful these rich people are. You do sort of go, well, did they deserve that? And also, let's not kid ourselves, Emerald Fennell is from the upper echelons of British society. All of that, so you know, the calls are coming from inside the house. Like, that's why I think it didn't work for me as well. Because if it was maybe like an inverted commas working class director taking the piss out of posh people, it might have worked a wee bit better. Whereas, because she is literally from the sort of salary bracket that she's making fun of, it just didn't land for me.
Yeah, because that's the thing as well. It's like, she's from, I think she went to Oxford, and fair enough, they've got good experience of that. But even at that point, I'm like, is she taking the piss out of them really? Because, as we say, Rosamund Pike's character is pretty fucking, like, shallow. And Richard D. Grant's character is quite racist towards the cousin and things like that. But at the same time, there's nothing overtly mean and nasty about these people other than they're just assholes.
Yeah. What I took from the character of Ollie was that he was a sociopath and he saw something that he could take advantage of. It wasn't planned to begin with. But it was he saw something that he could, you know, get into the middle of. And you could tell that all during the initial stuff where he was getting to know all the people, and then when obviously he rocks up at Saltburn, the plan was not foolproof. There were certain things that would go awry and were out of his control, but that it was done on the hoof, if you like. It wasn't planned to begin with. He didn't target this guy. He was going to target somebody, but he didn't know who that would be initially. And you can always tell that somebody's going to be a bad one, because he comes in at the beginning, the very first scene when he arrives, and he's all kind of meek and he's wearing glasses.
Yeah.
And then he loses the glasses fairly quickly, you know, so you're thinking, something not right there, yeah.
Yeah, see, and look at these three wee faces, because we all have our glasses on just now. We'd never take out a rich family.
I mean, here's a quote from Emerald Fennell herself. I drew from my own experience of being a human person who has felt that thing we all feel at that time in our life, which is that absolute insane grip of obsessive love. But obviously, I didn't go to the full lengths that some people in the film do. But that's only a particular plot subplot of the film, because it didn't come across to me that he felt rejected by Felix, so he decided to take down his entire family.
Oh, I think the rejection from Felix is clear. I think it is. I think,
yeah, but I don't think obviously.
I wasn't joining those dots either. But I do think the rejection from Felix is clear. Interestingly, it was funny because when the character of Oliver first walked into Oxford, and obviously one thing I did see that's quite identifiable, as it were, was when you first go to uni, it does feel like everybody knows everybody else and you're sort of trying to find your way and what kind of group do you join, and you know, it does make a difference who you sit next to, you know, at lunch and stuff like that. And I really, really loved the character that Ewan Mitchell played, who was in The Last Kingdom, which I've just finished watching, the sort of maths genius. And he was like, go on, ask me a sum. And he was like, no. And he just absolutely screamed at him, like, ask me a fucking sum. And yeah, that was really funny. But that was a relatable experience of when you first start uni and you're not sure who to talk to and you somehow get lumped with the maths weirdo who was also wearing glasses. So that was relatable. But I think that was probably the only part of the film where I thought,
Do you know, that scene reminded me of the first Harry Potter, when Harry Potter meets Ron Weasley for the first time at Hogwarts. And I don't know what that means. I thought it wasn't deliberate, but that's what it reminded me of. This fish out of water type idea. But yeah, it was funny actually, because when I was watching it, my first thoughts when it finished was, yes, it's like a talented Mr. Ripley. Very, very similar. But she's actually downplayed that, and I find that really strange, because it's very obvious. Whether it's been intentional or not, you can't come in and say, oh, the Hunger Games is like Battle Royale. Oh, really? I didn't really notice. I'm going to downplay these comparisons. Sometimes, whether you mean it or not, the comparisons are really, really obvious.
Yeah.
This was very much like that. And again, we've spoken about this a million times. You know, I'm not a big fan of people saying a film has to have a message, deeper meanings, deeper layers and stuff. You can watch something you just enjoy. And that's what I took at this film. It was something I enjoyed. I could watch it. But the film kept trying to tell me, look at all these other layers. Look what I'm doing. The satire of the British class. There's this, there's that. But I don't think it was telling it very well.
No, I definitely think this is one of these films that thinks it's saying something more profound than it actually is. And listen, see, if it was just an enjoyment level, I could absolutely take it at that. But as I've said, you know, within this pod, there was just too many things that were sort of, the threads were unraveling quite quickly for me. And I couldn't quite reconcile that towards the end of the film. Although I will say that the soundtrack was absolutely banging. So fair play to her for that. It was like a proper throwback to every single song that was out. Well, I was in the sort of, you know, what was it, early 2000s it's supposed to be. So yeah, it was, the soundtrack was excellent, but that's probably about as far as my, some of the performances were good, but that's about as far as my praise can go.
John, you're my favourite more than we were regarding the film, and although I did say I enjoyed it, I do have a lot of criticism of it.
Mm-hmm.
What about yourself in terms of things you liked?
I liked the way that it was set up. It was two distinct parts to it. There was a part, it was about 45 minutes long, and it concentrated on the university side and building up of the initial relationship. And then round about the 50 minute mark, it got very dark very quickly, where Ollie received a phone call, and you didn't actually hear the contents of the phone call, but the next thing he's at Felix's door, and that kind of changes everything round about there, and you're thinking, right, oh, and everything changes because, like, it's dark and it's night time, and it's when just after they finish the exams, and you know, he's pushed through the, that was a wee bit of a strange one, because obviously they'd had that conversation where Ollie was kind of pouring his heart out to him, or so it seemed, about his father dying, and Felix was really uncomfortable because he's not used to dealing with that sort of situation, and his idea of trying to, you know, he said, well, you can't do your exams, you know, that's the first thing he thought of, well, you can't possibly do that at the state you're in. So, but obviously went through with it, and then they had that conversation at the big party for the, it must have been like end of year party, and he's, you know, it was a sort of a heart to heart. Felix had decided, right, I can do something here for you, I can give you some advice, and his advice was, write your dad's name in a rock and throw it in the water, because it's an old tradition from their family. He says, I've only done it once and it was for my dog. So it's like a whole different level of shallow at that point. Mm-hmm. But everything changed right at that point when it was, you know, now come to Saltburn, and it just pivoted on that. And the second half of it was absolutely excellent, because you met all these characters and you thought, right, the Rosamund Pike character, she's a wee bit shallow, and then you get introduced to the rest of them. And like you said at the start of it, Thomas, there is nobody that you relate to at all, and there's no protagonist in this. Everybody's pretty horrible. And at that point, Ollie's real character, or the character that the real Ollie starts to come out, and you see bits and pieces of it, the way that he's able to find people's weaknesses, whether it's in like eating disorders or like family strife, like Farley, for instance, the American, he's there for a particular reason, and Ollie's one of these guys that can work out, you know, what a person needs most, and that's like sociopathic behaviour, let's face it, if nothing else.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's a film that sets up the power dynamic, that Felix has the power and Oliver's the poor wee guy that gets roped along for the night, and obviously very quickly it explains that that's flipped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I really enjoyed the second half, and it was in such a contrast to the first half. First half was straightforward, you knew exactly what was going to happen, but when you got to the start of the second half, and there was this sort of fish out of water element, a second element of a fish out of water as soon as he meets like the head butler and all this sort of stuff, and it was just, it developed really nicely, and I liked the way, like I say, there was layers and things, but there was elements that they brought into it, like as soon as he arrives he sees like a wee cabinet with four dancing figures inside it and all of this, and you're going, aha, that's a pointer, something's going to happen there, and you know, there's, and there was lots of wee bits like that, and obviously there was a lot of, you know, looking at people through the cracks of doors and all this sort of stuff, you know, people in the bath and, you know, like almost like spying on people all the time. His Felix's sister would be sitting outside his window at night and everything like that. It was quite good. And then obviously there was a big party where they actually visually showed you the type of people they were, because there was the father who was dressed up in his armour. I really liked that, because he said, oh, let's have a costume party. I can wear my armour. You think this guy's dying to do something? But Ollie had horns and Felix had wings. So it's like you were saying, this the Felix character is almost like an innocent. It's just what he does. You know, he's not doing any harm to anybody. He's actually quite a nice guy sometimes, even though he joins in with all the various conversations and stuff. But it kind of showed you what Ollie was, actually, because at that point he did have horns and he was kind of stalking people. So, yeah, that's pretty much why I liked it, you know. I'm easily pleased. You've got to remember that, you know.
Like I said, it's a film I enjoyed watching, but I don't know if I liked it because I don't think a lot of it works in terms of a narrative point of view. And another thing Fennel was saying as well, that she wanted to make a film so we sympathise with unlikable people. But and fair enough, you do kind of get that element to it. It's a bit of an extreme way to go about it. Plus, again, it doesn't feel like we're supposed to sympathise with them when it gets to the end. And Barry Keoghan is dancing about to Sophie Ellis Bextor with his dick out. And you're supposed to laugh at that scene. That's a funny scene.
Oh, I didn't take it as that at all.
Oh, I don't think it was meant to be funny.
I didn't think it was... No. It was quite a disturbing scene, because at that point I thought, right, he's got exactly what he wants, but it's not something that you switch off. So what's he going to be like after that? Now that and you're kind of thinking, whoa.
Sorry, that was very Patrick Bateman for me with the raincoat and dancing at you, Lewis.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's like unhinged. Like, he lined up the wee stones, obviously, one for each of the people that he'd bumped off. And for me, it was like, oh, that's the start of a collection. So I do get that. Although I will say he was very graceful when he was dancing about. I actually thought he was quite impressive, like when he was moving around. But yeah, for me, it was like, oh, obviously this is hinting at, like, this is just the beginning of this type of behaviour from him. Or had he done it before? You don't know.
Okay, if we get a Saltburn like franchise when it's just him murdering people, or we'll set it in the British and Ellis universe and have a crossover type thing. And, like, the character feels attraction. He goes to American college, starts bumping him off. Because it did remind me, it was attraction at points. Didn't have that fish out of water poorer character, so to speak. That was just all the rich assholes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was just, here's the class here, and that's it, so to speak. But no, I genuinely thought that scene was supposed to be funny.
I think, well, I thought at the time when I watched it that I was kind of hoping that, say, the scene between Ollie and the matriarch of the family towards the end of it, I would have liked the film to actually have cut off at that point and just stopped after she said, why don't you come and live in Saltburn?
Yeah.
We didn't, and there would have been a certain amount of ambiguity about the events that had actually happened before. And it's that kind of thing, you know, the spinning top and Inception, that kind of thing. It leaves it on, you know, it's open to interpretation.
Yeah.
The thing with this, but obviously, don't be wrong, we've got different interpretations of it, but I don't necessarily think that's deliberate of the storytelling, because it's very much a lot of us are hammered into you.
Yeah.
As you say, and the film crew made ambiguous, but it says, in case it wasn't clear that he killed Felix, let's show you what should be doing.
Yeah.
Aye.
Even right down to, oh, he put a pin in his bike. Like, and it's like, It was just, it was a very show don't tell, as it were. And even right back to the beginning, where he's sitting in his seminar group or whatever with his lecturer and Farley, and they talk about the Robert Browning poem, which obviously sets up for the rest of the film. But even just, I did chuckle to myself, because Oliver says to Farley, oh, so you're attacking my writing for the style but not for the substance. And this is definitely a film that, for me anyway, felt very style over substance. So it's quite an interesting wee line there that obviously she wouldn't have said that about her own work, but it was interesting.
No, And that I'm glad you said that, because that's what I genuinely think. I think there's a strange irony with this film that Emerald Fennell has made a film that's laughing at her, not with her.
Mm.
And I don't mean her personally as a person, but the story she's telling, it's like, yeah, people are really laughing along with this, so on board with it. They're more kind of pointing out, you haven't got your own film to an extent. That's a really arrogant thing to say. I get that. But I think it's what you say with that kind of thing. Like, she's like, no, I want the film to be like this. Is it the people on TikTok that are doing the dance in our big houses? I'm not saying, yeah, anyway, it's a pretty bold statement to say the directors missed their own point.
Hmm.
But I don't think what she's saying is necessarily comes across.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It was like, what I kept thinking of was, do you remember during lockdown when celebrities were posting pictures on Instagram saying how terrible it was to be stuck in their mansions? I was like, no, you're not getting the point of this. And I think part of it will be, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think part of the success of this film has been the TikTok thing as well. So as much as obviously people doing dances around their big houses are also missing the point, I think this film has done so well because everybody's talking about the dance scene, everybody's talking about the bathwater scene. Surprisingly, nobody is talking about the period scene, which I'm surprised because that shocked me more than anything else. But I think it's a film that's actually doing well because of the social platforms that have sort of taken it on and made it a trend. I mean, I think you can actually buy a candle that is scented like Jacob Elordi's bathwater, just to put things into perspective.
No, I mean, as a thing, it's for the period scene, I thought, you're trying too hard. And plus, again, it's what you said again, like, maybe it was telling, not showing. Obviously, it's just showing it. Obviously, there's limits that you can show on screen, but they had to tell you this scene is controversial.
Yeah. Mm. And also, when he starts rummaging about down there, she's like, you can't, it's the wrong time of the month. As if you wouldn't have guessed that from the fact that he was smearing blood down her chin. But anyways,
that's the kind of thing. It's like you could have just implied it rather than having to tell you. Yeah. But I'm actually surprised it didn't tell you the bathroom bit as well, so fucking explicitly, in case you missed it.
Well, you were sort of positioned to spy with Barry whilst he was having a chug, were you not? So I think it did show you that as well, in fairness.
How would the film would have went if Felix went, yeah, I'm into this?
Hmm.
Being in love with Oliver?
Aye, because his whole family were murdered based on the fact that he was into him. Which is a bit harsh.
Oh, no, see, I didn't think he murdered the family just because Felix rejected him. I just thought he murdered the family just because he was mental.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know what point his character... Has he always been a supervillain? Does he become this as the film goes on? And that's what I don't like about the film. I don't think there's a clear story progression. And I know you mentioned, John, about the evolution of characters and that these characters just are who they are. I also don't think that's clear because... His character is just saying, he's been told five different readings of it. They don't mesh to me. And you get a character at the beginning of the film, he's very kind of meek and looks fish out of water. Is he doing that for the camera's benefit? Because at the end of the film, he's then dancing about naked. Is this the same character? Or has he evolved into this character? I think he's all over the place. I think there's a very interesting idea here of this guy becoming who he is, but at the same time it's also telling you he's always been like that. So
yeah, well, you get the what I got from it was that he was always like that, because there was a scene where he went back home for his birthday, mm-hmm. and his mum and dad were saying, oh, you know, he's always been very clever, he's always been at the top of his class, that's why he doesn't have any friends, because he's so smart, he kind of left them all behind. And at that point you're saying, well, yeah, he's always been like that. If he had the chance to dance naked in his own house, I'm sure he would have taken it. Yeah.
And then he wasn't like the was it Michael? Yeah, that was his name, the maths guy who clearly had no friends just because he was fucking bellowing about maths every 5 seconds and wouldn't socialise with anyone. That's why he didn't have any pals. He obviously had no pals because either he was just bumping them off at an enormous rate, or because he was so sort of like slick at whatever you want to call it, that people weren't hanging around him for too long. Because if you think about it, Felix and Farley in particular do kind of, they very much ease off on him, obviously, as a few lies or whatever are uncovered, and you wonder if that's happened in the past, and that's maybe why he's lost people in the past. Like, they're not sort of infatuated with him to the extent that he's obviously infatuated with, well, Felix in particular.
Yeah, I mean, it's that kind of thing as well. You kind of look back at how they treated them. Yeah, it's pretty shitty. But come on, I mean, like the passive, the karaoke spit is a cruel joke to play on them. But
that was mean. Yes, I will give you that. Mean. That was horrible.
But we could all see it coming. Apart from him, who's this clever super villain guy, or was he playing along with it?
Again, I think he was playing along with it. I think.
Because that's even perhaps for me, because he's saying the lyrics, going, okay, it's clearly obvious now at this point, whether you know the song or not, you're reading the lyrics on the screen going, it's clearly taking the piss at him. Why has he not clicked yet?
Oh no, I think he has clicked. I think that's the thing. I think he is playing an act the entire, or for the vast majority of the time, he is playing the sort of poor infiltrator, if you want to call it that, you know, who just, you know, isn't sure what these rich people got up to, and, you know, gee shucks, he wears glasses and he doesn't have the right sort of cufflinks and stuff like that. He obviously is playing that part, I think, the whole thing. But that moment where he obviously felt a public humiliation from Farley, that then made Farley a target. So it shows you that he is just a psychopath or a sociopath, as John has put it.
Yeah, and he deliberately brings Farley up as well, because he says, oh, this is your song as well. So it involves him to do the same thing, and he obviously is more polished and carrying off the pretense, obviously, because that's one of the subplots of the film, that Farley isn't quite what he seems either. Mm-hmm. He's there for a particular reason, because his extended family is in a bit of financial trouble and he's trying to get money out of them, and it doesn't work out well, shall we say. There's a certain amount of resistance. What do they call it? Tough love. Yeah. Need a bit of tough love. You think, well, yeah, there's tough love and there's basically ignoring people. But yes,
yeah,
I thought it was an interesting thing with Farley as well, though, because it kind of indicated when he was coming up against Farley, saw him as being an obstacle. He was on sort of different class, but in the same sort of level. He was looking for a way in to this family as well, so he almost saw him as competition. Now, he tried to get rid of him without killing him to begin with. He did the whole email thing about selling plates to Sotheby's, and the guy got dismissed from the house, away you go. But then they had a conversation later and they said, well, yeah, you know, he'll be back. He always comes back. We always let him back in. And at that point, I think he clicked, well, if I'm going to do what I'm doing, then people are going to have to go. Here now, I think in an ideal situation, he would have liked Felix to stay alive and just manipulate him. But the way that it turned out with the revelations about his own family and everything, it wasn't going to work out that way. And it was at that point he thought, right, well, yeah, I'm going to have to do a wee bit more here. And as in a wee bit more, you're talking about, well, three direct deaths and one indirect death, I suppose. Yeah. You can't really say he killed the father. No. And did he take money? That's the thing. Did he take money from him?
I think he does. I think he accepts the bribe and leaves. And then once the father dies, he somehow manages to meet Rosamund Pike in a coffee shop by chance to then get back of her father. He could have just left at that point. I mean,
yeah,
he's got some money. But it's that like nut job part of him coming back out, that evil villain part, because it is at times a bit mustache swirly if you break it down. Like, he's sitting, like, the whole film he's kind of like talking to a deathbed type idea, and he's sitting, he could be saying, like, yes, and I did this, I did that, and I killed your son, ha ha ha. You know it is fucking quite comic book to an extent, and we've not even mentioned the fact that he fucks Oliver's grave.
I was trying not to.
And I don't know if that was a mark of respect, disrespect. Was he still in love with Oliver at this point? It's just too much going on in this film. I don't think it all matches for me.
So seemingly that was improvised. Seemingly in the script, they said, just like, you know, unbutton your shirt and sort of touch yourself a little bit. And he was like, oh no, can I improvise? And then decided to fully get his kit off and then obviously fuck the grave. But again, it was like, for me, I just sort of read as like, again, this is a moment where you're obviously trying to shock me, but again, because I had seen it all on TikTok and Twitter and all the rest of it, it perhaps wasn't as shocking had I gone in blind. But there was a lot of moments in this where it felt like they were shoehorning in something that was meant to make you go, oh my God, isn't that disgusting? Yes. But actually, you know, I've seen worse.
That's the thing. That's the thing. I'm like, who are you trying to shock and disgust in this? People that haven't watched films before. People that watch a certain type of film. People, you're going to watch this film at Christmas with your aunt or something, drinking rosé. Is this film aimed at middle to upper class? Or upper class even? And upper, so upper class watching go, oh, I'm appalled by that. But they're still lower than the Saltburn class, so they can punch up, so to speak.
I don't know, that was another TikTok trend, by the way, as well, was people watching it with their grands or their old aunties at Christmas, because it came out over Christmas, and obviously filming their reactions to either the bathtub scene or the grave fucking scene or the dancing scene or whatever it was. So that became a thing as well, was filming your reactions. Like I said, I think this film has sort of gained, I don't want to use the word notoriety, but certainly a popularity, because it has trended on various social platforms for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. The whole thing we are talking about of sitting watching it at Christmas with your aunties and stuff like that is actually mirrored in the film, because they have film nights and they're all sitting watching a film together, and they watch Superbad, and then they watch The Ring afterwards as well. So it's that kind of thing, and they all look, and it's, you're seeing their reactions to watching these films. The younger people are obviously enjoying it and laughing, but the two older folk are going, the fuck is this? It's on the screen. You know, they're doing that without actually saying it, because, especially with the Rosamund Pike character, because she wants to be the centre of everything. She wants to be in charge, the matriarch of the whole place. But she's really not that with it. She's very self-centred. It seems to be like her relationship with her husband is like the older gentleman who has met a model, and she's obviously quite well off anyway, but, you know, made her into this sort of lady of the manor type, and she doesn't know what to do with herself anymore, and she's relying on like past glories of like hanging about with Blur and Oasis and Jarvis Cocker, you know.
the joke that common people was about her.
Yeah, and she says it couldn't possibly be, because I've never been to Greece. Yeah.
I did like that line, and I also like the line where Carey Mulligan's character had obviously met her unfortunate demise, and she was like, well, she would do anything for attention.
That's the thing. Rosamund Pike is fucking great in it. Her character is excellent in a very darkly comic way. Even when Carey Mulligan's great as well for a limited screen time. And when she's saying, I mean, if you don't want me to leave, I can say, no, darling, you go. It's best you go. It's fine. You go. You know, and it's like, oh, man, these people are dicks. But again, they're assholes. They're dicks. That also had nothing to do with them being really rich either, them being assholes to that level.
No, they're just tone deaf towards her family, because if you think about it, she called her daughter sexually incontinent as well. And you're going, what the actual fuck?
I just kind of feel that, again, there was a lot of kind of things happening in this film that I keep saying it didn't all come together for me. But I could have happily watched a film just on that family. Because I thought they were interesting characters, especially Richard D. Grant and Rosamund Pike. I thought they were excellent in the roles. And you could have just made like a dark comedy based on them.
Yeah,
they were definitely the best performances. I mean, I must admit, I know I was joking saying that Jacob Elordi sounded like Prince Harry, but I struggled with Barry Keoghan's accent as well, because obviously he was meant to be Liverpudlian, and he did not sound Liverpudlian.
Yeah, he was. He was from Merseyside.
Yeah. So I struggled with that. Why they couldn't have just kept him as being Irish, and maybe his parents moved over to the UK or something like that, I don't know. But that kind of sort of, and again, part of me was reading too much into it, going, well, is he kidding on that he's from Merseyside? Because he thinks that sounds rougher and that'll get him more. I don't know.
You're right. Because even think that it goes and meets the parents are clearly English. But if you were to overthink it, go, oh, well, do you know what? A lot of Irish people migrated to Liverpool years ago, but that wouldn't explain his accent if his parents are clearly Scouse.
Yeah, that was a struggle. I would say that Rosamund Pike and Richard E. Grant were certainly the best in it. I really like the dynamic between the two of them as a couple, and also just some of the remarks they made were really funny. But yeah, I think as much as Barry Keoghan obviously won hearts and minds with the Banshees of Inisherin, I'm not sure this was his finest effort here. Don't know if you're allowed to say that.
It was still a better effort than Eternals.
I haven't seen that. You know, I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. Yeah, it wasn't particularly used well in Eternals. What he actually did was okay, but it wasn't on screen for very long, I should say. It was.
I was actually in a running joke in the film that Ned delights his character.
Mm.
And it makes sense if you watch the film because, yeah, you're not supposed to like him, but not in the right way. He's just annoying me. Get him off screen.
Mm-hmm. And you've got to remember, he did play the Joker very briefly as well.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's why I think it was quite interesting. I do actually see parallels between his character, Oliver, and Joaquin Phoenix's Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Joker is a very, very class divide film. And whether you agree with what happens with the film, when he shoots the guys in the subway, he kills this person, that person, he becomes the most iconic supervillain of all time. There's a lot of parallels of it, and I did find it quite interesting that Barry Keoghan does play the Joker, albeit briefly, in the Batman. Yeah. And if there's a sequel, no doubt he'll reprise that role. But he did in the deleted scene, the book release for the film as well.
Mm-hmm.
This could be a prequel to that.
Yeah, I could actually see that, yeah. I mean, have you seen The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
The Colin Farrell
film, the Yorgos Lanthimos film? He is, but it's a very intense performance again. It's bordering on that sort of sociopathic tendencies. But that's an excellent film. You should really seek that out.
So we're basically saying he's the new Ezra Miller without the controversies.
Give him time.
I think there's controversies.
He wasn't with Taylor, was he?
Yeah.
No, he certainly wasn't.
I'm just looking at some of his films here. He was in 71, which I've seen, but not in a lot, not since it came out.
Mm-hmm. He's also currently in Masters of the Air, Apple TV Plus, the Spielberg, Tom Hanks executive thing. It's very good. You can really see where the money is on screen in that one. He's in that. He's playing an American who has Irish ancestry as well.
I was going to say, how's the accent? But obviously that much.
It's actually not bad. It's you know, I'm not good with pointing out where in America some of these accents come from, you know, kind of know Boston, New York, and that's about it, you know, maybe some West Coast draw, but he's somewhere in between. But he's pretty decent in that as well, because he plays a very straightforward character in it. But yes, he is kind of cornering the market at the moment in these sort of disturbing roles, isn't he?
Looks wise, obviously, this is going to sound horrible, but you've got Jacob Elordi, who is going on to play Elvis and is obviously is he a Disney Channel product? But he's obviously quite the sort of quintessential all-American guy in terms of looks. Whereas Barry Keoghan, I think, is slightly more interesting. He obviously has these incredibly piercing blue eyes, and he's obviously got a lot of charisma. But, you know, back in the day, he'd probably been seen as like a character actor. So I think he is drawn to these sort of more intense roles because it's not just the sort of pretty boy. I think he is somebody who is sort of naturally drawn to the kind of darker stuff.
Yeah, I think so. He's very good at it, I think.
Absolutely.
I don't know what he'd be like in a out-and-out knockabout comedy or anything, or a musical, but yes, he's certainly got a certain intensity about him, which obviously lends itself to the film in a disturbing kind of way.
So I didn't watch Euphoria, so I wasn't really familiar with Jacob Elordi before this. But I see he's playing Frankenstein's monster in an upcoming Frankenstein film.
Which one is that? Because it's about three Frankenstein films coming out. You've got Guillermo del Toro's, Maggie Gyllenhaal's.
It's del Toro's.
Is it? Interesting. Because del Toro was scouting for locations in Edinburgh, so I don't know what they're using there, because usually the classic is the Necropolis in Glasgow, isn't it? So I thought they might have used that, but they're scouting for locations in Edinburgh. But that's interesting. I mean, I suppose if you were going to sculpt someone from scratch, you probably would want someone to look like Jacob Elordi, because I did also read that seemingly the, is it a Minotaur statue at the centre of the maze was based on his actual abs.
Really? I read it was based on Barry Keoghan.
Oh, really? I thought it was based on him. All right, okay, maybe I'm getting mixed up.
They look so alike, so it's easy to mix the two guys up, you know.
It's that kind of thing. It's Jacob Elordi, who could be that kind of new Army Hammer type thing, but there's an sort of
don't go there.
Boy.
Come on. There's, you eat one burger, you know.
Investigation regarding him in Australia. And I just want to get this entirely clear. Jacob Elordi involved in police investigation after an alleged altercation with video producer.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was been. Yes. That was. I was very much on his side on that one. That's where it was a producer for like one of the top Australian breakfast shows, radio shows, sort of caught him when he was having dinner somewhere and he was saying, oh, I've got this jar. Can you fill it up with your bath water, please? And at first they kind of played along with it. The guy was really persistent. He just told him, you know, away you go. And basically when he didn't, when he just kept persisting, did he not try and strangle him or something?
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, but everybody was saying, yeah, you're quite right. The guy got off lightly with only getting strangled. You know, that was terrible. Apparently it's one of these shows that has really bad reputation for doing these stupid stunts. You know, they were saying, oh, you know, it was just a bit of fun and all that. But when you actually see the film of it, there's people actually who were recording it as well. And it's, you know, it doesn't do the producer guy any favours at all. You know, he was just a dick. So, yeah.
It's a shame that people, I mean, obviously celebrities are a different class as well, because they obviously have a different sort of lifestyle, but the fact that people can't go for dinner without being pestered seems a bit insane. It's obviously not glassing a waiter, Sammy.
Yeah, I mean, plus he's Australian, so he's going to be a bit kind of...
Wait a minute, is Jacob Elordi Australian?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he was American. Why did I think he was some like Disney Channel guy?
I thought it was actually English when I watched Saltburn. I thought his accent was great. His mandolin.
Oh no, it reminded me of, do you remember you sent me that clip of Prince Harry narrating his book when he was talking about rubbing Elizabeth Arden 8-hour cream on his peen? Yeah. It sounded like that accent to me.
Yeah, I think that's what worked for me. He did come from that working class family. So I thought he actually played that, whether it's very stereotypical, very like cartoonish almost, maybe you say Prince Harry type character in Saltburn. I thought he was really good in it. But he's probably cancelled now because he's trying to strangle a DJ.
But depends if the internet is on his side or not. You know fine well that most celebrities live or die by what's been said about them on various social platforms. So
I mean, let's be honest as well, it's like Anthony Starr could have murdered that waiter and people would still be like, you better be cancelling the boys.
I know, it's funny because obviously on The Boys, everyone's like, God, he's really amazing at playing a psychopath. Like, there's actual anger in his eyes and you're looking and going,
It's the same when you watch Cobweb and you think, man, there's something not right about this guy. And then you go, oh, that's... And there isn't. So digressing ever so slightly there into being rude to waiters and waiters being rude to you and what can happen to the waiter in that situation and strangling DJs, which maybe not what Morrissey had in mind. However, I am now interested in that part of the podcast we'll get. Do you think this is a film you would recommend? Maybe.
Do you know... No, because I think once you go over the whole, oh, it's so controversial thing, there's not enough to it for me, I'm afraid. And as I say, the sort of main sort of joy for me was the Rosamund Pike, Richard E. Grant performance, and obviously the soundtrack, which is going on my Spotify immediately. But it just wasn't enough to hold it together for me. And the minute I started asking questions, it all sort of fell apart. So I'm afraid I wouldn't recommend it. Sorry.
Yeah. I would, but with the caveat that it's a film that's quite divisive. Some people will really like it, some people will really hate it. And I would obviously say, yes, I'm one of the people who do really like it. But, you know, opinions may differ and you may have the wrong opinion. So, and you're welcome to it.
I actually would recommend the film because I think it's a film you want a discourse involved in it, either as well, just watching it for yourself. And like I said, I thought it was very enjoyable when I was watching it. And for me, though, that idea of it being controversial is controversial, in my opinion, to the same sort of people that think it's edgy to drink Buckfast. The kind of people that are sitting in Glasgow University back at someone's gaff, and somebody will bring out a half bottle of Buckfast to share between 10 people and take pictures of it and like, oh, look at us, well, yeah. They'll probably watch this film and find it quite controversial because...
That's a very specific insult.
Yeah, it's very detailed, down to the fact that there was 10 people and half a bottle, yeah.
What can I say? Mary knows about Glasgow, you know, done a film course, and yeah.
I was going to say I did the same course, not at the same time, but imagine our paths had crossed.
God. I remember that's the same course to try to convince me Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom was not a good film. I don't go wrong, a lot of things I actually said about the film at the time, I can actually quote back and go, do you know what? Yeah, it's a bit racist. However, I didn't even told that during a film course. I didn't even told Indiana Jones is racist. I don't need people to mock Independence Day. You know.
What films were you watching? I didn't get to watch any of this stuff.
No, we did watch Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, but I can't remember, it was something somebody mentioned and they went, oh, I mean, not Independence Day, and everybody kind of laughed. I mean, Independence Day is fucking brilliant.
That just takes me back to, we had to pick, sorry for this tangent, but we had to pick a Shakespearean adaptation to discuss with one of our sort of seminar groups, and everyone picked really highbrow options, and me and all my pals did The Lion King, and our lecturer was fucking seething.
But that's the problem. That's the problem, isn't it? The fact that your lecturer was seething is ridiculous.
I know, because it is an adaptation of Hamlet, and I will stick to that until the day I die. But she was obviously expecting something, you know, like proper and highbrow, probably featuring Kenneth Branagh.
And that's what I find this film struggles with. It almost like it tries to beat everything at the same time. In that it, I mean, some of the reviewers for this film are, it's so multi-layered, you go back to it, it's like cinema and all that. I'm like, fuck off, man. It's a good film, in my opinion. It's watchable, it's enjoyable, but let's not put it on a pedestal because that's almost, again, against what I think the film's trying to tell you.
Was it in cinemas or was it straight
to... It was in cinemas.
Yeah. November.
Okay,
yeah.
Ah, right, okay. I thought it was just a straight-to-streamer thing. And actually, maybe seeing it in the cinema would be different because obviously it is quite visual. It's quite... Obviously, Saltburn itself is very decadent and over-the-top and there's lots of sort of... blood reds and there's the blue room and the library and all the rest of it and the east wing and all that sort of thing, so maybe seeing it in the cinema might have had a different effect. I don't know.
Yeah, get to hear the cheeky girls and glorious 5.1 sound. Yeah,
a gothic thriller dusted with poisonous candy pop glitter, its endless visual and literary layers will bring its ardent admirers back to it again and again because it's a triumph of the cinema of excess, it always orgiastic and apologetic glory. That's somebody that's almost seen a film, and it's this one, in my opinion.
How many films have you seen? One.
Yeah. Well, I got a thesaurus for Christmas. Orgiatic. Yeah, very good.
So, moving swiftly on from Saltburn, we did discuss in the chat about doing our favourite naked dance scenes in films, but the lists that came up for inspiration. We're a different podcast completely. That's a Patreon content where you get some visual aids.
I think I'm on a list now, yeah.
Yeah, I think John's John Chauvet in Cornito mode. Always going Cornito mode, John. Some of the films that came back and that's probably just a VPN as well, just to make sure.
Think so.
However, we can always discuss. In fact, we would like to invite our listeners to let us know what your favourite naked dance scenes are in films. Yeah, there's some good ones. You've got like Jamie Lee Curtis in True Lies. She's not naked, but again, it's that very sexualized dance.
Showgirls. There's lots of tits and bums in that.
Yeah, you've got Return of the Living Dead. There's a cracking nude scene in that when everyone's dancing in the graveyard.
Not familiar with that, but I feel like you really are.
You've never seen Return of the Living Dead. Oh, man. based on a true story.
In fairness, I didn't think that a film called Return of the Living Dead would have a nude dance scene, so you have broadened my horizons for this evening.
It's basically like a sort of, I wouldn't say it's a spoof or a parody of Return of Night of the Living Dead, but if you're out in the 80s and it's just a bit of a tongue-in-cheek version of the films.
Right.
Yeah, it's fucking mental.
I feel like 80s films probably do have a lot of naked dance sequences. I feel like that's a very 80s thing.
Yeah, it's very much a... I think that's very much just like a prerequisite for certain films. Does this film have a naked dance scene? No. Can we put a naked dance scene in it? No, probably. There's a lot of cocaine flying about here, lads. We can do what you want.
Was there not one, a scantily clad scene in From Dusk Till Dawn as well?
Exactly.
And what was it, the bar, the titty twister? Was
the bar. That's a fucking awesome scene as well.
Yeah, because that transitions from just a thriller into a horror film, just not one scene.
That fucking insane. But that scene is amazing, it really is.
Yeah.
Do you know, I found out this week, no, but do you know what I was going to say? I found out this week because I was on the Vampire Videos podcast discussing an absolutely terrible film. But they said, have you heard of Dusk Till Dawn 2 and 3?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was, Simmy, like, you will have at least heard of these, if not seen them. But I didn't realise there were sequels. I know that's one with George Clooney. Is it Salma Hayek? She's the kind of sexy.
Yeah,
she is really hot. I would watch pretty much anything with her in it. But I didn't realise there were sequels, so I also learned that this week and thought that you'd be probably quite familiar with them.
I wouldn't recommend the sequels, to be fair. But honestly, it's a cracking film. And I know you've said before you're not too big in George Clooney. His performance in this might change your mind in terms of this film. He is
in
fucking
fairness,
excellent in it.
I don't like Rosamund Pike, but I actually really enjoyed it in Saltburn as well, so I'm open to changing my mind.
I have never seen, don't worry, this film is almost 30 years old, but I've never seen George Clooney do a role like this before or after.
Yep.
It's incredible. You've also got Juliette Lewis, Harvey Keitel. It's a phenomenal cast. Harvey Keitel, again, a very different kind of role he has in the film. Script by Quentin Tarantino, but written by the guy that also wrote Wishmaster, whose name escapes me. And obviously me and John went and did the Wishmaster franchise a few years back. You can find that in the Movie Scramble Archive. But as much as, like, obviously, we're busy people, where I get a chance to read a lot of stuff, watch a lot of stuff. And when it comes to watching stuff, we're not necessarily spoiled. So we are spoiled for choice when it comes to all the things at our fingertips. You get Amazon Prime, you get Netflix, you get Apple, you get Disney Plus, which goes on to our next topic, being there was something you mentioned earlier on, Mary, about Disney Plus is putting its prices up. And over the course of 4 years, it's went from 50 quid, 60 quid, 80 quid, and now they're saying 109. For context, it's actually misleading. Disney's prices are technically not going up for the annual subscription, unless you want to, it's a 4K deal or something like that. So, but you can just keep the price as is. They're not being clear about that. And people are actually cancelling based on it. And that's Disney's own fault. I do think it was quite funny when they said, we hope you're enjoying it. We're updating our prices so we can keep bringing you brand new originals and the latest blockbuster movies, which nobody likes. The reason you're putting your prices up, because you're losing money on this content you keep shoving down people's throats. You keep trying to tell the audiences, this is what you will like. And audiences are saying, but we don't. And they're proving that by not turning up for these films in the cinema specifically. When it comes to streaming, obviously, it's hard to gauge what's popular and what's not. It'll get renewed or cancelled, one of the two. But the audiences Disney seem to want are the audiences that have been with them this whole time. And they're now catering to a different audience and they're not turning up. And the audience they did have are now in the Watch Sister Fire. So they're a mess for another podcast in its own right. But regarding streaming services, obviously Amazon Prime put the prices up. Netflix, apparently it's a thing in America just now, where they're having a premium service where if you're on the ad service, there's certain things you cannot watch. There's certain content, so to speak, films, TV shows, that are only available if you pay the extra premium. So, over to yours, I'm curious what you think the current state of streaming services are and what the future looks like for it.
I'll let you go first, Mary, because you've been your three-word answer for this.
Yeah. Too many platforms. I was actually thinking about this earlier, so I didn't know that was the reason that Disney were changing their pricing structure. However, actually, I probably will still bin Disney Plus because I got it for The Mandalorian, and I don't think there's any more of that in the offing just now. So I've got Disney Plus, Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Shudder. And obviously I pay for like Sky and like supplementary stuff on Sky. But there's so many nights where I just think there's absolutely nothing that I want to watch, which is kind of embarrassing on the sheer volume of streaming services that we have. But I think that they're all, I mean, they all have something to offer, right? So if you like, you know, for example, Drive to Survive or You're Selling Sunset or whatever, you'll find that on Netflix. Amazon, obviously, they've got The Boys. That's their sort of big ticket thing. And Disney, obviously, are trying to use their Marvel and Star Wars content as their sort of reason to purchase. But I just think that because a lot of these, well, from obviously a novice or whatever, or uneducated outsider looking in, I look at a lot of these streaming platforms and it's like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but there isn't actually anything that I want to watch. And that's part of the problem is that, okay, you obviously need to populate a platform with content, be that films or TV shows or whatever it is, but I'd much rather there was less content and it was good and I could find something that I wanted to watch than just acquiring stuff for the sake of it. I mean, don't get me wrong, Netflix is useful if you like a wee Scandi drama and stuff like that. It's got lots of access to things like that. But I guess that, well, even like Amazon Prime are sort of diversifying to include things like Champions League or the tennis and stuff like that as well. So they're all sort of trying to find their own kind of wee niches in various different pockets. But I just think there is no, it's not sustainable that even if you have the most basic subscription, so your £6 Netflix or, you know, your cheapest Disney Plus or, you know, the whatever the cheapest sort of Amazon Prime thing is, there's just no way that's sustainable on top of what everybody else is paying for, you know, even just basic Sky or whatever you want to call it or Virgin. I just think it's become almost laughable how many streaming platforms there is, and it's like, oh well, if you don't have HBO Max you can't see this, or if you don't have Paramount Plus you can't see that. And that, I mean, there's no way people are buying 5, 6, 7, 8 streaming services. It's become a joke.
No, I think that's a good way to kind of put it. It has become a joke, and as you say, a lot of the stuff, you've got this stuff, and we say, if not spoiled for choice, and we're not, if we've got time to sit and look and hunt through things, which we all have that running joke of, you spend more time streaming, switching through a service than you do settle on something. Let's be honest, sometimes it's not always, the algorithm's not always giving you stuff you want, and you need to hunt for stuff, and you go, I didn't realise that film was on there. It's not always clear and good. And a lot of original content, I'm going to pick on Disney for this one, because I don't like The Mandalorian that much personally. It's a personal thing. Phil does.
Oh, it's lather, rinse, repeat. I was watching it for one reason, yeah. Let's be clear.
Yeah. I didn't watch Boba Fett. A lot of people didn't like that. Andor was apparently really good. They cancelled that with the looks of it. Yeah. The Marvel stuff fell off a cliff quickly for me. And Netflix, whenever I see a Netflix, if I go to Netflix and see a Netflix film, I'm more turned off by the idea than I am intrigued by it, because Netflix films are usually this generic algorithm, script, and never, I very rarely see, oh, a Netflix film, I quite fancy that. Prime, I do think there's some good stuff in Prime, the same as anything. As you say, Prime's got other stuff to offer, it's shown sport. Also, you know, different benefits with Prime. It's not just the streaming service, that's just part of what you're paying for. Apple, but I've had Apple a couple of times, and what they have a different quality of shows. Their shows are very cinematic. There's a specific craft, almost maybe, in their stuff. You can see the efforts from putting it. John, you could maybe explain that better.
Yeah, like I said, there's a certain sheen to a lot of Apple stuff. It's very well produced. They don't just throw anything onto the service. It seems to be very well thought out, and they ensure there's a certain production value on everything they do, and it shows its quality. It might not always hit the mark for whatever reason. There's a new drama on there about Christian Dior, for instance. I watched about half an hour of the first episode. it wasn't particularly good. It was quite dry, and you know, doing cod French accents is
the worst.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's Ben Mendelsohn, you know, so
that's why I wanted to watch it. I thought it looked like a good cast. I didn't realise they were all
it's a good cast, but it's not, but that's just a personal thing for me. You can see even then there's still the production values are very high. It's quality over quantity with Apple more than anything else.
Which is refreshing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the thing. If you're going to Apple compared to any other streaming service, there's not as much on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do have options to buy things on it in the same way that Amazon do. But yeah, you go to Apple for the quality content. They have quite a slightly different way of doing things as well. They release things episodically once a week. You'll get something new for something. So it's an occasional jump into Apple rather than, or you wait to the end and you binge the whole lot, for instance. But yeah, the stuff is really good.
You guys just come back to what Mary was saying there about regards to like Prime bringing out like the sport and things like that, and kind of having that more something else added to it rather than just here's a new show, here's a new film, here's some stuff you like previously in there. Netflix have struck a deal with the WWE to host their content from 2025. Now, WWE has its own network with all its back catalogue, and its monthly pay-per-view events are now just called premium live events, because the pay-per-view model for them is kind of more or less dead. In America, they already sold the version of the network to Peacock, and now they're doing it out nationally for Netflix. Is this something you can imagine happening with streamers at the start, just merging? Because you say, Mary, there's a lot. Even look at Prime, for example, you get Amazon Prime, great. Oh, look what's under there. Shudder, Lionsgate, Canal.
Hulu is also on there, which used to be its own thing as well on Amazon.
Arrow Video. These are all separate add-ons that cost between £5 to £8 or whatever it is. Before, you used to buy Sky. So usually Red Sky or Virgin, anything like that, cable, whatever you want to call it, and you had hundreds of channels of pish. Now you have hundreds of streaming services of pish.
Yeah.
This says, yeah, it might be better by point to say, I'll spend a tenner for Amazon or Netflix, blah, blah, but you can't pay for each individual channel that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is frustrating sometimes when you go on like Amazon, for example, and you search for a film and it says we have it. So you're like, oh, great. Then you click on it and it's like, oh, but in order to get this, you have to, you know, pay £5 extra a month to get a subscription to a certain channel or whatever. And that is a bit frustrating because, as I say, it's not feasible for people to have, you know, 10 or 11 streamers at £5 a pop, or maybe it is if for some people, but certainly not for most normal people. It's not feasible to have that on top of everything else. And I think that there is potential that a lot of streaming services will merge and the big boys will buy up the smaller ones. But again, if they're charging them as an add-on as opposed to just swallowing them up and subsuming all the content, it defeats the purpose, really, of having the sort of merger, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's pretty much that way. It's like the house always wins, we know that. So they'll find a way around it. Like Spotify, for example, things like Napster came out and like music became digital and it became a lot more accessible and free, but they capitalise on that. And they're doing the same with streaming services as well. The thing with streaming services I find interesting when it comes to films, now they've opened Pandora's box and they're trying to shut it. You can't give everybody this stuff and say, well, you know what, you can go and pirate it. Oh, you can spend £5-7 a month and get the quality. And they're like, well, yeah, we actually want you to pay more for that now. In fact, you may get adverts and they start giving you less and want more money from you.
Yeah.
That's not a very good business. It may be good for cinema and things like that again, but I think they're just getting... It's greed, let's be honest. Like Amazon, for example, does Amazon as a company need more money? They're not making losses anywhere. I mean, take Disney, for example. They are making losses at the box office. And they're like, right, let's try and recoup something here. Amazon Prime... It's just making profit after profit after profit. Take it for the rest of Amazon, just Prime it itself. And they went, yeah, we could make more. And it's like, yeah, you could, but you could also just leave it as it is. Because the bubble will burst.
Yeah. Well, John made an interesting point before. I can't remember if it was another pod or just we were chatting. Like, there are certain films and TV programs where the advert breaks are built in. So you know that 50 minutes into a 30-minute programme, you're going to get a break, and that's time to go and flick the kettle on or whatever. But I just feel like with Prime in particular, because it said they're introducing product placement as well, so they're going to be shoehorning it in Amazon products, I assume, but then also shoehorning in ad breaks when programmes aren't necessarily being made to factor these ad breaks in. So it just creates a very weird viewing experience as well. It's not a natural break. Like when you watch American TV shows and stuff like that, you can see where the, you know, you can pretty much time where the break's coming up, and it's the same for British sort of terrestrial telly. But it's going to be an awful viewing experience with all this sort of like random stuff just shoved in halfway through a program.
And it's only going to get worse as well, let's face it.
My experience with Amazon with adverts so far has actually been fine. Any advert that has come out, I'm mostly watching Walking Dead, which was major adverts in mine. But any films I've watched since, the adverts have come in, surprisingly, at quite a relevant point in between scenes. There's nothing been jarring so far. It's actually been fairly, it's not made me want to pay extra to get rid of them. They have a function, which again, they're taking this away. This is something they already had on Amazon, and again, they're taking it away and giving you less for more. A channel called Freebie, and it's just free stuff. It's just a wee extra add-on for nothing, but again, I take that away now. That, however, is barely watchable because the adverts are just flung in like halfway through a sentence and things like that.
They can't possibly introduce a new element like adding ads without going through the hard process of going through every single piece of content that they have and programming adverts into it. Yeah. That's a full-time job for a whole team of people. So they just shove them in whatever they feel
in
like.
In fairness, that's what Channel 4's seen just near 4OD. It is the absolute pits for adverts. And do you know how, I don't know if Amazon do the same, but seeing Channel 4 when you have like the streaming bar of how long the program has to last, and you can see those little yellow dots where you know there's going to be like 25 ad breaks in a half an hour program. But they're terrible for doing it like halfway through a sentence and stuff like that. It's so frustrating.
Amazon does. And like I said, I haven't noticed any issue with Amazon so far.
Which is reassuring.
As you say, John, it's that kind of thing. It's maybe you're not going to get somebody sitting doing that. Are they using AI to say find a natural break in the scheme and put an advert in? I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. Whereas with Freebie, it's just like throw an advert in at some point.
No, the way I see it running with Amazon is they say it's with limited adverts, but they haven't said what limited adverts actually means. So at the moment, it's like a couple of 30-second adverts at the most, but you'll find that they'll add in more and more. I mean, look at the likes of ITVX. Their content is pretty much unwatchable because they have 4 and 5 ad breaks during a film, and it just completely ruins it. It just, you know, any tension that you may have, because it's like halfway through a scene, they'll just chop off. I think that's what happened. Amazon will get used to the bump in ad revenue, and they will add more, and they'll add more. It won't just be limited anymore. You'll find instead of like one advert, you have two, and then you have three, and it might be a wee bit longer, and it might be two adverts or whatever, you know. Instead of 30 seconds, it's a minute, and they'll just build on that. But the thing with Amazon is the way that they did this, they introduced an ad tier, but if you wanted to have ad-free experience, you had to pay more. You had to go up a level, whereas Netflix introduced an ad tier, but it was a more basic tier. It was going down from like $7.99 to $4.99 a month, and you got ads. But like you say, there's all the stuff about what they said it was licensing issues with things. I don't know if that's because they were sold to the streamer without adverts been involved in or something, or it's just an excuse for cutting out content. It's still pretty bad, but at least with Netflix, anybody that was on that tier stayed on that tier. They could choose to go down, but Amazon, you have to choose to go up and pay an extra £36 a year, whether you actually pay monthly or whether you pay annually. So if you're in an annual contract with, say, a broadband provider, that's what you pay. But with Amazon, I mean, I'm only halfway through my 12 months. I pay it annually. And it's like, if you want to pay, if you want this, then it's an extra £3 a month. And you're like, nah. And like I say, it's not wholly intrusive at the moment, but I think it's going to get worse. It really is. Disney Plus, on the other hand, did it slightly differently, and they were very fly about it. Basically, they created a whole additional tier, because everybody's on, they had one tier which was premium, and that's what you started on, and then they introduced a lower tier with adverts on it, but you could choose to go down to that. But when they decided they were going to put the prices up, or before they decided they were going to put prices up, they moved everybody who was on the premium tier onto this almost like premium tier plus. So it had all, like say, 4K and the Dolby Atmos elements to it, which was all just part of the standard. But it was very quietly done. So now all the changes are coming in the 24th of March, and they've said, you know, your price is going up by £30 as well. It's crazy. And if you want to go down, and like there's certain benefits, you can share up onto 10 screens or something like that, or something wild. But if you go down to the previous tier, the one that everybody's on at the moment, then you don't get 4K anymore. There's a limited number of screens you can watch it on. You can still download stuff. I think you can only download to like two devices or something like that, two nominated devices, which I don't do anyway. Stream, like if I'm over at the gym or whatever, I still stream stuff via Wi-Fi rather than like downloading or whatever. But so it's not that big a deal. I've gone down to the price point I'm at the moment with Disney because I'm keeping it going, but I will see, because there's not that much new stuff coming on there that I'm particularly interested in.
There's The Bear, which is the only thing that's keeping me there. I do wonder, will this drive people back to the cinema when the streaming experience just becomes so poor and frustrating? No, you don't think so?
I don't think it'll drive people back to the cinema. I think people will get a lot more choosy about the services. Yeah. And now it's an interesting point you said about streaming services coming together and forming alliances and things. There's a lot of talk about that already with HBO. They're in talks with the likes of Paramount and things like that, because Paramount came in quite late to the game, and they've got a reasonable catalogue, and they've sort of siloed off all the Star Trek stuff and the likes of Yellowstone, one of the biggest hits in America. And you can't really see that anyway. You occasionally get it on Channel 5 because it's the same company that owns it, but there's not the same buzz around these programs because hardly anybody watches them, because you can't
access the platform. Yeah.
There is talk, but what we'll find is when these services join together, it won't be a price point midway between what you're paying for the two. It'll be just for the price of two of them, and there would just be a lot of content on there that you don't want. It's going back to the sort of cable channel, like you say, hundreds of channels and very little that you actually want to watch. And another thing, I'm on a bit of an Amazon rant now. What we're paying for them is a drop in their profits, because they've shelled out for the likes of sports and Champions League football, and I don't think they're getting the return back, because people are still using the likes of Sky to watch a lot of the content that they would be watching before in terms of football and all that. And the likes of, was it $750 million they spent to gain the rights to the Lord of the Rings TV
franchise. Not really
they're trying to recoup that money based on their mistakes. And with Disney, obviously, it's the fact that their profits have gone right down the tubes as well, because of they're not getting the punters into the cinemas to see these films that they're making. So they're not having the same impact when they're actually going onto the streaming service. It's not an attractive proposition. I think what we're going to find is people will be very choosy about what they watch. Same idea as what you said, Mary. If there's a new season of The Mandalorian come on, people will subscribe so they can watch that. And so even if they do it, people will get quite savvy about it.
Yeah.
Even if they do it on a weekly basis, they'll say, well, I'll wait till the month where it's the last four episodes are actually coming out.
And then I'll get 7 day.
Yeah. Have it for a month and then take Amazon for a month and then take Netflix for a month, whatever, you know, and watch what you want. I think that's the way it's going to go, unfortunately.
See, I agree with that. And that's the kind of thing I was thinking I was doing. And to be fair, the only thing I actually subscribed to just now is Amazon Prime. And like I alluded to earlier, I just don't have much time to sit and watch a series. So I don't need all this stuff. And I don't really feel like I'm missing out. I don't have time to watch it.
Yeah.
I do think, however, that streaming services will get wise to that and it'll take away the monthly option and it'll become subscriptions on a more longer term. So you can't just dip in and out when you feel like it.
Yeah.
But the house always wins. They'll find a way around it.
They've cut back on all sorts of things because if you remember, all these major streaming services started with the, you know, we're not cable TV, we're not going to have any ads. And then it was like Netflix basically promoting password sharing, you know, share it with family, you know, Netflix and chill, you know. Yeah, so, you know, it's a communal experience and everything, you know. And then when they realized that they could make more money from people not using the same account, then it's business, isn't it? Let's face it. But it puts people off because the content really isn't there for them, I don't think, in terms of like it's all very, I mean, Disney has a massive catalogue of stuff, basically because they own MGM's, they own Fox. So yeah. They've got all, and I watch some of the stuff, I watch the likes of NCIS and NYPD Blue and things like that. But is it enough to, and that's just re watching stuff, but is that enough to sustain an ongoing subscription?
As for how much of your stuff are you watching because it's there, you're sitting going, John, my fans watching Predator, watching Disney Plus, great. But I'm also, go put it on DVD.
Yeah.
It's just to see, put it on. I think what we might see is maybe not necessarily like drive back to the cinema, but we might see more of a resurgence of physical media. The second hand market at first, anyway. Maybe the kind of vinyl went, you never know.
Well, yeah, because especially with the likes of, well, it was HBO was the big one, wasn't it? They took quite a lot of their content off that they actually owned. They made it and owned it, but because of the residuals that they were having to pay for that, they just took it off of their service altogether. And some of it had never actually come out on physical media, so it just disappeared. Like some of the Westworld seasons, I think the last one wasn't released on any sort of physical platform. All that's doing is just driving people to stream it illegally or download it, whatever, you know. It's going backwards in a certain way. But yeah, what I was going to say about Amazon as well is, like you said, about all the wee add-ons you can get if you want Shudder or if you want everything, it's just a wee additional cost and all that. But with those accounts, it's linked only to Amazon. So if you say you've got a BFI subscription that you buy outside of Amazon, you can't log in to BFI on the Amazon app.
You're joking.
Nope, it has to be through Amazon that you do it. So if you've got Shudder through
which
Amazon,
which we do, we have Shudder through Amazon.
Yeah, so you couldn't say to either me or Samuel, you know, just give you a wee shot of that for a while, because it's through them. And it's the same with pretty much every service they've got. It's separate to the actual app itself. It's rubbish.
That is rotten. I just feel like at every turn, it's like trying to squeeze the most money at people. And it's like, if you could see the evidence of where that money had gone, don't get me wrong, as I say, I'm currently binging Drive to Survive on Netflix, but that's just like a side watch to watching the actual Formula One. It's just like extra background information.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you could actually see where the money had gone, rather than, you know, what was that film? Was it with Chris Evans that was on Netflix and they actually said they had got an algorithm to write it? Like that's just absolute bullshit. That's just and it flopped really badly, and it, you know, all this sort of thing. And it's just, like I said, if you could see where the money was going, you would feel justified in spending it. But there's a couple of things that I'm thinking, oh, that would probably fall under Fox, or it would fall under that. Should we keep Disney Plus? But ultimately, I think 30-day free trials will become 7-day free trials, and it'll become 24-hour free trials before that whole thing is just phased out completely, so that you do have to actually commit to a platform.
And like you say, Thomas, the monthly thing, I think they'll still do monthly, but it'll be a minimum term. It'll be three months or 6 months that you have to take it for. Yes.
I mean, here's the thing. I've got YouTube, premium YouTube. The music selections is what I look for. I love watching the videos without the ads. I was shocked to find when I was looking for stuff on Spotify, there was stuff I couldn't find. Certain albums. And that, I'm like, okay. I understand there's licensing, you're not going to get everything, but I was quite shocked with the amount of stuff I couldn't find.
Yeah.
And when it comes to, like you were saying there, but some things like HBO Max, for example, it just doesn't exist in physical mm-hmm. media. So where can you get it? Quite famously, Michael Flanagan's film Hush
mm-hmm.
no longer exists. It's not streaming. It was never released in physical media. You cannot find this film legally.
Mm-hmm.
That is, do you know, funnily enough, we were watching, I think it was, we finished Vikings at some point last year, and I went onto the Vikings subreddit and was like trying to see what other people were thinking of various things. And about a month after, I noticed people were saying, oh, I'm halfway through season 4 and they've taken it all off Amazon. Or I got to, you know, season 5 and these two specific episodes are missing. And it's like, yeah, because when you go to the cinema and you pay your $10 or whatever it is these days, and you sit and you watch the film, they're not going to cut out like a random 50-minute section or like send you out halfway through the film. Whereas because these streamers own this stuff, it's quite possible that you could be halfway through a show that you love and it just disappears the next day, and there's no recourse for that as well. It's mental.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it can disappear and then come back a couple of months later, depending on whatever licensing they've got. There's stuff on Amazon that's marked as Amazon exclusive, and yet you have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was free on the service, but the licenses ran out on it, whoever sold it to them. It's a mess. It's a real mess, and it's only going to get worse, unfortunately. And I hate saying that because I like watching things on streaming, and I like the fact that there's all sorts of different stuff that I can watch. Now, I've got past the fact of not being able to watch things because I've created watch lists on each of them, stuff that went, and even then I can still scroll through, you know, spend some time scrolling through, but I've got like an ever-growing list in each of the services of stuff that I want to catch up on, so it's easier and more straightforward. But if I had to bin a couple of them out of the, I think I've got Amazon, Netflix, I've got access to Apple through a family sharing, which is legitimate, obviously. I've got Mubi, and I've got access to some of the Sky content as well through a reciprocal arrangement with my mother. So she's got access to one of my services, which is perfectly fine, you know, but that's the way to do it, to stop paying money. But if I had to lose two or three of them, it'd be fine. It'd be all right. I don't think I'd miss it particularly, to be honest, because I've got enough stuff to watch anyway. And like I say, I've got walls of physical media sitting here,
yeah.
You know, DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff, so I think I would be fine.
And on that note, remember this podcast is free.
Yes, at the moment, until we do that.
Until we introduce our own pricing tier.
Yeah.
We're not selling it to any streaming service yet, but if a Spotify or a Amazon want to pay us, then by all means, we'll be shells.
Yeah. Maybe they'll revive your OnlyFans page, Thomas, as well. You never know.
Did you see John Cena's created an OnlyFans page for a character he's playing in an upcoming film?
All right.
You're joking.
Well. I can't really details if I don't know what the film was, but he's created an OnlyFans for the character. An official, actual OnlyFans you can subscribe to for the character he's going to play in this film. That guy is dedicated, man.
Nice.
That is. But then what happens if it's just like all you would see would be like a pair of socks or a pair of pants?
Yeah. On that note, I think it's a good time to bring the podcast to a close. Thank you very much, John and Mary, for taking time at your busy Sunday evenings to discuss Barry Keoghan's Knob.
You're so welcome.
Yeah, anytime.
I'm sure the bold badger will be listening to this and going, thanks, guys.
He did confirm that he wasn't wearing a prosthetic as well.
I did confirm that, yeah. Did you see that clip when they asked Andrew Scott, he's called the guy?
Yes.
They asked him when they were, and he's like, he was trying to play him, but it fair play to him. Because if that was Jacob Elordi,
that was good him.
Yeah. His hands would have been around his throat in seconds.
But yeah, if you want to catch us on the social media to discuss Saltburn, if you liked it, didn't like it, if we've spoiled it for you, they give you a warning, so that's on you, or anything else to discuss streaming services, or recommendations, shout at us, abuse us. We got off on that kind of stuff. I'm not gonna lie. You can contact us at Movie Scramble across more or less anything where you can find social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Bebo, Threads, usual nonsense. You can also email John personally. John, what's the email address again, please?
It's Movie Scramble. No, it's not. It's podcast at moviescramble.co.uk. It's been such a long time since I've even looked at it.
This is why I need John to do this, because I'll still get it wrong.
Yeah, well, I did as well, so, to be fair.
If I'd been spectacularly wrong, I'd probably call it. You call it Movie Scramble. But on that note, it's a pleasure and a privilege as always. Whether you like Saltburn or not, sure as hell had fun talking about it. And hope you've enjoyed the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed making it. And we will see you again soon.
Bye. Bye.